On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, a town meeting on the federal budget, the Republican perspective. We are honored to welcome back Dickinson alums, Congressman Jim Gerlach and Congressman Bill Schuster, and to also welcome Ted McCann and Molly Hooper. Jim Gerlach, Dickinson class of 1977, has been a public servant since the 1990s, when he began as a member of the House of Representatives in the Pennsylvania legislature. He later served as a state senator. After 12 years in the state legislature, he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 2002, where he represents Pennsylvania's 6th Congressional District. He is serving his fourth term in Congress, and he is currently a member of the House Financial Services and Transportation and Infrastructure Committees. Bill Schuster, Dickinson class of 1983, was first elected to the House of Representatives in 2001 and has served the 9th District of Pennsylvania for more than 10 years. He currently serves as chairman of the Subcommittee on Railroads, Pipelines, and Hazardous Materials of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and is a member of the House Armed Services Committee. Ted McCann is a budget analyst for the Republican staff of the House Budget Committee. In this role, he is the lead analyst for income support programs, Social Security, pension policy, and agriculture policy. McCann also spent 9 months as the lead House Budget Committee staff member for the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, otherwise known as the Fiscal Commission. He assisted this commission in policy formation for their final product, The Moment of Truth. Tonight's forum will be moderated by Molly Hooper, a staff writer for The Hill, a congressional newspaper that publishes daily when Congress is in session. Index cards were placed on all of the seats this evening. If you have a question for the candidates, please write the question and your first name on the card. These cards will be collected by Clark Forum staff standing in the outside aisles. If you would like to pose a question and did not receive an index card, please raise your hand and a Clark Forum representative will bring one to you. The cards will be collected now and during the final question posed by the moderator. I would also like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Now, please join me in welcoming tonight's moderator, Molly Hooper.
Well, thank you very much, Siobhan. I really appreciate being here. It's so nice to take a break from the inner beltway, palace intrigue, and actually talk some policy tonight, not talking points on the economic situation currently in the country. You know, over the past few weeks and months since House Republicans have taken control of the lower chamber, it's felt like finals for us in D.C. I mean, members in Congress have been passing legislation, cramming night after night to get major pieces of legislation through to avoid government shutdowns. And in fact, they were able to do that with a deal to cut $44 billion from current spending. But for a lot of Republicans, that wasn't enough. And what really turned a lot of members was when the House Republican leadership said that they'd go ahead and take a vote on Paul Ryan, the Budget Committee chairman's, path to prosperity. So instead of dealing with billions of dollars, now Congress could tackle trillions. And tonight we have Ted to discuss this, as well as obviously two distinguished Dickinson grads who, though they aren't on the Budget Committee, are in the thick of what's going on in Washington, D.C. So, Ted, if you could explain in a nutshell, in layman's terms, so we all can hear.
Is that possible?
That's what I'm hoping you're going to help us find out. How does this budget process work?
So we'll go through very quickly how the budget process works. I'll try not to put everybody to sleep. But basically what we have here is a number of the major budget activities that occurred this year or have already occurred. What happens first is in mid to late January, we get the Congressional Budget Office's baseline. Basically, this is what we start using as we formulate our budget. This is what we compare our deficit numbers against. This is what we compare our outlay numbers against. This is what we compare our revenue numbers against. February 7th, the first Monday in February, the president submits his budget. This year was February 7th. Unfortunately, the president actually was 2 weeks late, and we didn't get his budget until February 21st. But that kicks off the budget process, into sort of hyperdrive. We get the president's budget, we analyze it, we see what he has proposed, and then we take what we like out of his, and then change what we don't like. In late spring, we write our budget. In between this, we receive the CBO's re-estimate of the president's budget, where CBO estimates what the president's budget actually does using CBO's economic model rather than OMB's model. OMB is a creature of the presidency, so they're sometimes captured. But we put out our budget in late spring. We have the markup, where the minority party is able to provide amendments and have their input into what our budget is. Some amendments we accept, some the vast majority we end up rejecting. But we did accept two amendments from the Democrats this budget process, this budget cycle. April 15th is the statutory deadline for when the budget is supposed to be done. Last year, the Democrats did not end up putting forth a budget. This is the first time since 1974, when the Congressional Budget Act was passed, that no budget was passed through the House. There's been four other times when a conference report was not agreed to for FY99, FY03, FY05, and fiscal year 2007. Once we pass the budget, basically what this does is sets a framework for federal spending for the next year for the Appropriations Committee, and then the next 10 years for the authorizing committees. A way to sort of visualize it is we sort of build a framework to a house, but the various authorizing committees, that'd be Ways and Means for taxes and for Medicare, Energy and Commerce for Medicaid, the Ag Committee for farm subsidies and food stamps, they're the ones who actually design the policies and implement the policies. We just tell them how much money they're allowed to spend at the end of the day. In mid-May, after we pass the budget resolution, we begin the appropriations process, which is 12 appropriations bills. We provide the Appropriations Committee with a level of funding, and then they divvy up that money into what are called 302B allocations, which are basically we provide the allowance and the Appropriations Committee decides how to spend the money. So they get a set level of funding, and then they decide exactly how much each program is going to get funded with. That's supposed to be done by the end of the fiscal year. Typically, this is one of the reasons we ran up into the CR this past year. Typically, it is not done by September 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year, requiring us to do a series of continuing resolutions, which basically keep the government from funding or keep funding the government until we do get a final appropriations process completed. The other major budget things that are going to be happening this year will be the debt limit. That we should be hitting is what Treasury is telling us in late May, early June-ish. Treasury has a number of options to sort of delay when we hit the actual debt limit through basically playing around with the various trust funds that the federal government holds. But those are the major budget actions that occur through the budget cycle. This is a complicated chart showing exactly how that happens. Basically, on the right side there, you see what happens to the Appropriations Committee. We provide the A allocation, and then the Appropriations Committee goes through the appropriations process. We vote on each of the 12 appropriations bills that are split up by the area, by subject area. And then on the left side is the Authorization Committee. Basically, we provide assumptions on what the Authorization Committees can do in order to meet the targets that we have. However, the Authorization Committees are not bound by them in any way, shape, or form. The only way we can force authorizers to do something is through reconciliations instructions, which basically says by a date certain they have to save the amount of money that the budget says that they need to save. And so then they would provide legislation that would save that amount of money, and it's privileged through the Senate. It's a sort of a complicated process, but that's basically how it works.
Well, thank you very much, Ted. I hope everyone can hear me now. Is this a little bit better? The perils of being tall. Mm-hmm. So Congressman, why was Paul Ryan's budget so moving? Why were Republicans so galvanized behind it? What was so special about this year?
Well, first of all, thank you, Molly, for doing this, for coming up. And Ted, thank you for doing this. And it's a great pleasure to be back on campus with you tonight. I think maybe one other additional piece of information before we get into some of these particular discussions on proposals one way or the other is giving a sense of what the current year spending amount is. It's about $3.6 trillion, $3.7
trillion? $3.6, yeah.
Okay. And how much revenues have we gotten in to spend that amount? About 2.4. So we're going to have about a $1.3 trillion deficit this year. And if you looked at the pie chart of that $3.7 trillion spending plan for this fiscal year, about two-thirds of that Our entitlement programs like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. The other third of that approximately is discretionary spending, which is all the other areas of the budget, including highways, education, funding for the National Institutes of Health, National Park Service, etc. So two-thirds of the budget's running on automatic spending requirements because of those entitlement programs. About a third is discretionary. We can adjust those numbers year after year. And so the battle I think that we had coming up to the vote on Paul Ryan's budget for fiscal year 2012 was, as Ted mentioned, we still didn't complete the budget for the current fiscal year. And it's the first time since the 70s that that hasn't happened without a budget even being passed in the House. So we were just dealing with how to get through the rest of this year and fund everything government needs to do for a six-month or so basis. And that's where we're getting into discussions of how much to cut because of the fact we have been running these trillion-dollar-plus deficits year after year after year, to the point where, if you look at it this way, for every dollar the federal government is spending today, we're borrowing 42 cents of it. So I don't think the college would do very well spending a dollar every day and having to borrow 42 cents of that for all of your expenditures. Certainly businesses can't do that. Families can't do that. And so we really are in a spending crisis. And the question is, how do you get out of it? And that's really where then these discussions on Paul Ryan's budget proposal and the other proposals have been put forward. That's sort of setting the stage of where we are on those budget proposals.
And I'll add to that, I think the reason that we galvanized behind it is because it was a budget that made a lot of tough decisions. I can tell you that there's some parts of it I would rather have seen changed here or there. But I think that fundamentally, we all came to the conclusion that, and I think America has to come to the conclusion, that we've got to make some very tough choices in reducing spending. It's not going to be easy. Everybody needs to share in the sacrifice. And this budget addressed one of the big problems we face is Medicare. And how do we save Medicare, and how do we save this nation from financial ruin? And I think that what Paul laid out for us and the Budget Committee, because it just wasn't Paul, there's another, 20 members, Republican members on the committee. They did a great job of tearing through this budget and trying to figure out where we could cut, where it made sense. And he puts us on a path in this budget that it's still 25 years or so before we get to paying down $4 trillion in debt and balancing the budget. But it puts us in a path that it's not going to put us into a tax trap down the road if we cut so drastically that at some point someone's going to come along, some Congress is going to come along and say we have to raise taxes. It deals with the revenue side of it, broadening the tax base, decreasing taxes on the job creators in America, which is what's going to help us. And I believe that with this budget, lowering taxes, fiscal restraint, we're going to see the economy grow greater than projected, and I think we will get to a balanced budget sooner than the 30 years or 25 years or so. So I think it's a reasonable budget in a time when we have to make some very, very tough decisions. And I've been traveling my district the past week, and I like to remind people or ask people to watch this commercial on television. It's a Chinese college classroom, 2030, and they're speaking in Chinese. And the professor is showing pictures of the great civilizations of the world, the Greeks, the Romans, the British, and the Americans, and how they went into decline. And it was because they overtaxed, they overspent, they collapsed financially. And this final line, he says, in Chinese with the English subtitles, is, that's why the Americans work for us now. And that's a very powerful commercial, and it really lays out where we're headed if we don't make these tough choices. I think this budget was a very good piece of work.
And just a reminder to everyone, if you have any questions, anything you hear up here sparks curiosity, please fill them out, and I'll start asking them in a few minutes. But, I wanted to follow up on one point that you made, Mr. Schuster. President Obama disagrees with Republicans, surprisingly enough, and he calls the Paul Ryan budget radical. He says that it won't work. He says that it ends Medicare. But there have been a few websites out in the ether that have disputed those notions. Can you explain what Paul Ryan's budget does with Medicare and why you think that would work?
Well, first of all, for people 55 years and older, it doesn't change a dime in it. people 55 years and older are going to get the Medicare system that is currently in place. What it does say is people 54 and younger, because this system, and as Paul likes to say, it's complete fantasy if you believe Medicare as we know it today will survive. So we have to do a reform. We have to reform it for future generations. For many of you sitting here, if we do nothing, there will be no Medicare. There will be a bankrupt United States of America, an economically weakened United States of America. So what he's done is 54 and under, we've got to go back and we've got to figure out a system that we can sustain. And I think what he's put forward is to, just like federal or similar to federal employees like Jim and I or anybody in the federal government, you get choices. To a government program, government-sponsored, government-approved health care providers that you can go in and make the choices. If you want to have a bare-bones health care system you don't have to pay much for, then you pick that one. If you want to have sort of the Cadillac plan of health care, you're going to pay more for it. And those in our society that are the poorest and the sickest will get more, and those in our society that are more well off, the folks that make a bigger income, they'll get less. And I think it's a fair plan. It's something we have to look into and explore it and make those changes.
And Mr. Gerlach, President Obama has also been out on the at his various town hall meetings. He was with Facebook yesterday, saying that instead of changing Medicare the way that Ryan would like to change it, you know, basically you need to take in more money in tax revenue. And mm-hmm. I know that you're now on the Powerful Ways and Means Committee, the Tax Writing Committee. I'm wondering, what reforms do Republicans want for the tax system? Because I understand that Republicans aren't happy with it as it is right now. So, yeah. So what do you think?
Well, first of all, I applaud the president for finally understanding that we have a spending problem and a long-term debt problem. Just a few months ago, he presented his fiscal year 2012 budget proposal that Ted just mentioned in that time period. And what he was calling for was just a freezing of federal spending, which would result next year in another $1.1 trillion deficit. And so a lot of us felt that's just not a serious enough proposal to really start dealing with our debt problems. Just a week and a half or so ago, however, he put out some more proposals talking about what he would like to see happen to deal with our debt issue. And for the fact that he's talking about it is a good thing. Now we've got the president engaged, we've got the House engaged, we've got the Senate engaged, and that's a good thing, certainly. Not that we agree on how to get to the end result necessarily, but at least you've got to get everybody on the same page issues-wise. Yeah, I think everybody agrees we need to cut spending in certain areas. We need to drive the cost drivers of that debt long term down. As Bill was mentioning in Paul Ryan's proposal, there is going to be offered an opportunity to move Medicare into the type of system that exists today for those that are on Part D, Medicare Part D, which is the prescription assistance program, where when you join as a senior, you have a choice of plans that you can take from in deciding what's the best plan for you. That's what's being talked about in Paul Ryan's proposal. It's not a voucher proposal, as been indicated in some of the media outlets, because a voucher proposal is simply taking federal tax money, giving it to you as a check, and then you going and deciding what you want to purchase. Like the Part D program for Medicare, what this would be is the senior chooses what he or she wants, and then the federal government supplies a premium support to pay for that plan. So we think that's a better model for bringing more competition for health care services to seniors. The Medicare Part D program is actually about 40% below what it was budgeted to have because of that competition. We think that's a better model. But at some point, yeah, do we want to see increased revenues as well? Yes, and I think Republicans and Democrats can agree to that. The question is, how do you do it? I think some on the other side of the aisle simply want to do that by raising taxes on people of higher income. And they think that's going to generate enough money to deal with our debt problem. There's plenty of studies out there saying that if you tax those over $250,000 or $500,000 or a million, you could tax them at 60% of their income, 70% of the income. You're still not going to raise enough revenues to deal with the debt problem that's going to occur just from Medicare itself when you now have 10,000 folks every single day becoming eligible for Medicare and Social Security. The baby boomers have started to retire, those born in 1946 through 1960. 1964. There's about 10,000 a day coming into the retirement system. And you can tax those at higher income levels, at those much higher levels. You're still not going to generate enough funds to deal with the ongoing mandates that these programs have. So I think our effort is not only to try to long-term deal with these programs structurally, but also realize that we can grow the economy, hopefully, that will generate more revenues to government at all levels. And that will be one of the other legs of the stool to bring this whole budget into balance at some point down the road.
And actually, I've been looking through some of these questions, you've actually hit a few points that people were wondering about. You know, in particular, David Milson asked, will raising taxes on the rich work to help the debt? Ella also asked, you know, why are Republicans for the House so opposed to increasing revenues, which would be necessary? The budget can't be on cuts alone. And from what I'm seeing in these questions, why would Republicans be opposed to some sort of combination of raising revenues, maybe, like on people who make more than $250, and reforming the programs in the way that Paul Ryan is saying? I mean, would Republicans be opposed to that?
Well, we think we all want to raise revenues. The question is, how do you do it?
Okay.
Take a couple examples like states of New York and Maryland. They had the so-called millionaire's tax in those states. Mm-hmm. Guess what? Folks of those incomes decided to leave those states and go to lower tax states. If we create much higher tax rates for folks here in the United States, they can take their money elsewhere. They're going to vote with their feet and put their money into other foreign depositories, and so they're not taxed here in the United States.
And Mr. Schuster, you look like you want to say something.
Well, I see Professor Weissman up front, so I want to talk about the lessons of history in the recent history of the United States. In the 1960s, President Kennedy cut tax rates. In the 80s, President Reagan cut tax rates. And in the 2000, President Bush cut tax rates. In each of those cases, when you cut tax rates, more people go to work, more people invest, and what happens is there are more revenues coming into the federal government. After the Bush tax cuts in the 2000s, there were record level of revenues flowing into the federal government. So by decreasing taxes, you allow people to invest, create jobs, invest in the economy, and putting more people to work, that in the end ultimately generates more revenue. So by cutting taxes, we believe on our side of the aisle that's the way you increase revenues. And to start out by saying let's increase taxes instead of starting out saying let's cut spending, let's restrain spending first and go from there along with these tax cuts, I believe it's going to work, and the history I think bears that out.
A lot of questions that have come up here actually have been on that theme. And I guess maybe it's because of the current situation we're in. People look back to the last president, George W. Bush, and they see that the spending exploded, wars weren't paid for. What lessons have House Republicans learned from the way President George W. Bush ran things? And the programs that came to being under a Republican president.
Well, because I don't know what we've collectively learned. It's hard to figure that out. But at least in my experience, is that if we're truly in the long term going to have some constraint on the growth of federal spending and federal government generally, we're going to have to do what states already do, and counties and school districts and boroughs and cities. We have to have some structural limitation on how much we can grow spending each year. Now, whether that's a constitutional amendment for a balanced budget or whether it's some statutory limitation on how much you can grow spending, I think we institutionally have to get that in place. Since World War II, historically, the federal government spent about 18 or 19% of our annual GDP, gross domestic product, what we produce in goods and services every year. Federal spending has been about 18 or 19% of that. Right now, it's 25% of that. Next year, it'll be 25% of that. And so we're just spending too much relative to what our economy and economic growth is at this point, and we've got to get some constraint. And to me, at some point, we need some sort of institutional way to do that year in and year out.
All states, I believe, do capital budgeting. The federal government doesn't do that. We buy a new fighter plane the same as we treat a paperclip. The impact is, so we need to, the way we budget, I think Jim's right on the money, structurally we need to change the way we budget, the way we spend, and at the end of the day, I believe the lessons that we learned were that we can't continue to spend and not adjust. other things. If we're going to go to war, then we need to adjust our budgets in other areas. And I think that that's the main lesson. And also, people like to look at the Bush years as the Republicans controlled both houses of the Congress. We didn't. And when you don't control both houses, as we see today, we can't do everything that we want to do. There's compromise. There's things that that we get into bills that we don't necessarily want. But if you're going to pass a defense authorization bill or a highway bill or a HUD bill, you have to take things in there that you don't necessarily want. And a lot of times it's more spending that occurs.
Well, you know, there's another question in here that has to do with recent news that on the S&P and the U.S. debt downgrade warning. You know, what are the ramifications for the U.S. government borrowing and interest rates? Any thoughts?
It's very scary. Standard & Poor's is a credit rating agency. They rate the creditworthiness of all levels of government, including the United States government. Right now, the United States government has a AAA rating, the highest rating you can get. That's great. We want to keep it there. But recently, Standard & Poor's said that there's a 1 in 3 chance over the next few years that they're going to have to re-rate the federal government to a lower level. Well, if that were to happen, all of a sudden interest rates for everything would start climbing. The interest that we would pay on the debt that we're continuing to incur, and that debt is this year $1.6 trillion. So we have to issue $1.6 trillion in bonds, incur that indebtedness, and then factor into our next year's budget that additional money to pay on the interest on that debt. And so if that debt rating goes down, the cost of that indebtedness is going to go up in terms of higher interest rates, which means even more taxpayer money has got to go into the budget each year just to pay interest on the $14-plus trillion debt we have today. And if anybody thinks that's a sustainable, reasonable, rational way to handle the people's money, I'd love to see what the empirical basis or economic basis is for that conclusion, because I just don't think it is.
Right, and we're going to spend, what, about almost $500 billion on servicing the debt this year, $400
billion? This year it's a little bit less, but by the end of the president's budget, it's $900 billion. And if you saw a spike in interest rates, that would... We're at very, very low interest rates currently. Right. And the CBO budget economic analysis has interest rates... a little bit lower than historical averages. If we went up to, say, the 1980s interest rates, you'd get in a debt spiral that would be very, very difficult to get out of.
Right.
A question from actually, there's a few questions on this, but that brings us to another question. Lots of them. the debt ceiling. Can you explain what's going on with the debt ceiling right now? Why do we need to raise it? Why is it such a big issue this year? How has it changed over the past few years?
Well, maybe Ted should just explain what a debt ceiling is, and then maybe Bill and I can give a view on what we think about it. But maybe, Ted, you can explain
what it is. The debt ceiling is basically the amount of money that the Treasury is legally allowed to borrow. There's two forms of debt. There's debt held by the public, which is sort of the bonds that you typically think about when the Treasury goes out in the open market, sells bonds to be able to purchase, provide current services. There's also intergovernmental debt, which are typically non-marketable bonds. This is the money within the trust funds for Social Security. This is money that's within the Civil Service and Retirement and Disability Fund. This is non-marketable debt that's intergovernmental in nature. Until this past January, the House always passed the debt ceiling through a rule called the Gephardt Rule, which basically stated that if once we passed a budget resolution, the debt ceiling was assumed to be raised by the amount of debt needed to fund what our resolution said. We got rid of that rule. Republicans did in their rules package at the beginning of this year. So now the House actually has to vote on this. So.
And the last time we voted on a debt ceiling was January 2010, I believe. Yeah. That's correct. We went from 12.7 or 8 trillion to the current level of 14.3.
Yeah.
And it's, as I think Ted said earlier, the end of May, beginning of June, we're going to hit that level. The president's out there saying, and the secretary, that we must pass it immediately. I'm not of that thought process. At some point, we have to do it, but there are ways the federal government can cash flow itself for probably 3 months, probably the end of the summer or something like that. And during that time frame, we have to be in and our leadership negotiating with the president to get some spending caps, to get some reforms on how we're spending. And I won't vote for an increase in the cap unless we have some of that occurring. It's probably not going to be as much as I'd like to see it. But I know that our speaker is going to be in there fighting the fight to get those caps, maybe a balanced budget amendment passed. That's going to be a tall order, but I think that's something we have to be in there negotiating for. This is in a split government that we have. This is going to be a very a tough negotiation, just as with the CR. But this is really the big fight of this summer and of this year. And again, I'm confident that we're going to go in there and we're going to get as much as we can to again control spending, get those caps and other reforms passed when we do eventually raise the debt ceiling.
Well, I think the way I look at it, at least, is the Congress and the President have already by law decided how much money to spend. And when we come to this thing at the end of May or June, the debt ceiling vote consideration, that means that our spending is reaching that prior level of indebtedness, and we've got to agree to allow it to go up to the levels of spending that we've already seen passed into law. So on the one hand, what you're saying is we have to increase the debt ceiling just to pay the credit card that we've already obligated with those additional expenditures. And yet the climate out there in my district and I think in Bill's district and all across the country is you just can't keep increasing the debt limit of your credit card. At some point, you need to draw a line in the sand. And so I think a lot of members are going to say, we understand we have to pay our bills, and we understand if we don't pay our bills, there's going to be some impacts on the economy and on the markets. But at the same time, this is a prime opportunity to get something institutional in place that puts some long-term constraint on the growth of spending. And so I think it's very uncertain at best as to whether the House and Senate's going to pass a debt ceiling increase in May or June. And it'll all depend on whether, again, the House, the Senate, and the President can come to some agreement that, yes, the debt ceiling would be increased, but along with that, there's going to be an agreement also to put some controls on long-term spending. So that's what I'm personally waiting to see, what that package looks like before I make a decision what I'm going to do as the representative for the 6th District.
Okay, so does that mean we have to call Susie Orman up and have her come down to the House and Senate to work on a budget?
We should take everybody's opinions and thoughts, and now's the time to speak up if you got a good idea on what to do.
But it, you know, at least with the last debate over the continuing resolution and funding the government through September, I mean, if there was a government shutdown, it was tangible. You could see it. People wouldn't get paid for their jobs. If the House and Senate, the President, failed to raise the debt limit, what does that mean? What kind of changes will we see if we don't pay our bills? And who are we paying our bills to? To whom? I mean, because we can't really declare ourselves bankrupt because we're a sovereign team. I mean, what
eventually
what happens?
We'll default, and it'll have a significant impact in the world if the United States of America defaults on its financial obligations. So I once again, I think Jim makes the point. I think as we move through this, we're going to see the President come to the table, get some kind of reforms that we need. But I don't believe that it's good in anybody's interest for the federal government to default on its loans. If we default and we default significantly enough, there's only one country in the world that can come in and help us out of this financial problem, and that's the Chinese. And that's when I come back to this commercial I see on television. You know, we're moving in that direction. And so we need to, again, seriously talk about spending caps and the other types of reforms we need to see.
You know, another on a different note, there have been a few questions about energy subsidies and why the United States government has been spending so much money on energy companies, and you know, why wouldn't the Republicans want to redirect some of that money, those taxpayer dollars, to subsidize renewable energy research and production? In fact, there's three or four questions on that.
Well, I think that's a great point. I think we ought to look at all of those subsidy issues across the board, not only oil companies, but also alternative and renewable energy companies. If we're going to subsidize something, it means the federal government's taking the policy that by subsidizing it, you're going to create more of that activity. And certainly, I think the rationale behind subsidies to oil companies, and it's not just Exxon or Chevron, it's also a lot of small oil and natural gas development companies down along our coast. But you're trying to encourage them to do the development work here domestically rather than taking that same operation to the Middle East or off the coast of Brazil or off the coast of wherever. We want to create the opportunities to create a domestic energy rather than foreign-based energy. But we ought to take a look at whether we're accomplishing with those subsidies, and again, not just oil, but also wind, solar, hydroelectric, nuclear. What will give us ultimately, in my opinion, the best opportunity to become energy self-sufficient? We have a tremendous amount of energy sources here in our country, and I think we ought to be taking a look at all of those energy sources, in addition to efficiency and conservation efforts, too, to ultimately break our dependence on the foreign oil and natural gas, particularly Middle East and Venezuela, and become energy self-sufficient. So if we're going to try to encourage that kind of activity, what should be the right tax policy? What should be the right development policy to make that happen across the board, regardless of whether it's oil, natural gas, wind, solar, et cetera?
But you agree that that is an issue, I mean, a problem, energy subsidies.
It's when I say we ought to look at everything, it's got to be based upon what we want the outcome to be. And if we want more production of domestic energy, and we're not going to see that happen in the private marketplace in and of itself, then you have to try to encourage that with some sort of subsidy policy. But I don't know enough about the subsidy policy today to know what the current subsidies are and whether they're fair or not fair, whether they're a good buy for taxpayers or not. But certainly it ought to all be examined, and we should come up with a rational policy across the board for all energy sources.
Mr. Schuster?
Well, there's the misinformation out there that the oil companies, they do make big numbers in profits. But when you look at the percentage, the return on investment, the percentage they make, it's lower than other industries in America. For instance, the Googles and the Microsofts make a much bigger percentage in profit than the oil companies. The oil companies are global companies, most of them, the ExxonMobils of the world, and if they're trying to explore and we are taxing them and reducing their return on investment, they're going to do like other countries, like many of our manufacturing companies have done. They're going to go elsewhere to explore for oil, find oil, to get the return their shareholders want. So I don't believe the tax policy over rewards the oil companies. I think that we just saw the president go to Brazil, and we're going to give the Brazilians $3 billion to drill offshore, and he said, we will be your biggest customer if you have it. Well, why aren't we off the coast of the United States drilling for oil, figuring out where the oil is? Because we have trillions of barrels of oil, billions, hundreds of billions, and I believe it's trillions of barrels of oil underneath both our coast, off the coast. You know, we've got to be out there exploring for oil in the short term, and in the long term, having a policy that is, as Jim pointed out, looking at all the other alternatives. Wind and solar are a small piece of the solution, but nuclear power is going to be a large piece of it. Gas, and here in Pennsylvania, we have a tremendous opportunity to revitalize our state so that we don't continue to lose population, that we can bring jobs here. And if we have inexpensive energy, the other resource we have here, it's extremely important to drawing people and companies here, is water. We've got to make sure we do it in an environmentally sound way when we're drilling for this gas, but we have to use this energy source to, again, revitalize the state of Pennsylvania, and it's going to be a big part of the energy solution in the United States of America.
Well, when you see these natural disasters that have happened over the past year and a half, 2 years, off the coast of the Gulf and in Japan with nuclear, how does that affect, can you explain how that affects the debate on that particular issue in Washington, D.C.?
I think it affects it a lot, and it should. Mm-hmm. We need to understand what happened with the oil spill, the BP oil spill, why there was not an emergency preparedness plan if that rig were to undergo the mishap that it did. We need to understand what's happening in Japan, and we need to take those lessons and recirculate those lessons back into our domestic nuclear industry and make sure that same kind of thing doesn't happen. But let's not kid ourselves. If our economy is going to continue to grow, we want it to grow so that there's going to be jobs for you when you leave Dickinson College. We have to have a growing economy, and that economy is going to have to run on energy. And so we're going to have an energy policy that delivers the amount of energy necessary to see that economy grow domestically. So that to me means, rather than being reliant on fossil fuels the way we are, we're going to need to do that for decades to come. But let's try to also incentivize the use of renewables and alternatives and even nuclear power. And let's make sure those that want to create jobs here in the United States have the energy sources at a reasonable cost to do so. Otherwise, if it costs too much to undertake that business activity here in the United States because of energy costs, then they're going to go across the border to Canada, they're going to go to Mexico, they're going to go to Brazil, they're going to take those jobs to other parts of the world. And we're going to be left stranded by not having those jobs here in the United States.
I'm going to jump back to the Ryan budget. Andy wants to know whether, you know, neither the Republican plan nor the President Obama's budget plan says which tax expenditures would be repealed in order to broaden the burden to lower rates. And he's wondering what specific deductions would you guys eliminate, would Republicans want to eliminate?
Well, I think there's some specifics in the Ryan budget. It's we're reducing tax rates from 35% corporate tax rates, tax rates from 35% to 25%. Keeping in mind that the United States now is officially the highest has the highest tax rate in the industrialized world on corporations. So we reduce that to 25%. Take the six tax brackets we have, shrinking them. I'm not clear on that. Is it two or is it three?
Well, I mean, the we don't specify the amount of tax brackets. Basically, the budget cannot provide those specifics. It's just the way the budget works. What we do is set a revenue floor, and we basically said, look, this is the amount of revenue that Ways and Means has to reform the tax code. They cannot go below this level of revenue. And the level of revenue is just what current policy is, where it is currently. And what we say is, and I think what Chairman Camp would like to do, is reduce the corporate tax rate down to 25%. Reduce individual tax rates down to 25% and lower other tax rates as well, and do that through
broadening the code.
Yeah.
Today, 47% of Americans don't pay any tax, and that is a problem. If you don't have skin in the game, 47% of Americans, they're not paying any taxes. They're getting some sort of benefit from the government, whether it's a tax credit or some other form of a government program. So I think that's wise that more Americans are participating in their government and paying for their government. And I think the other thing that Ted pointed out in that the Republicans have been criticized since we took over the House was, first we came out, we were working on the CR, and every Sunday morning I turn on those TV shows and I hear those pundits pounding Republicans. You don't have any specifics. You're not dealing with entitlements. And the speaker's been saying, "All, give us time. It goes through a process. We're in the process now. We have a budget. The budget has laid out some of the blueprint, but a lot of the specifics. And as Ted said, that's going to go to the Ways and Means Committee. Is going to really put the details in when it comes to how we spend money on defense. It's going to be the House Armed Services Committee. When it's transportation, it's going to be go to the Committee of Authorization. It's going to determine exactly what the details are. So we're going through this process, and as we move through it, we're going to see more and more details, sort of putting meat on the bone, if you will, to these different programs.
I think there's some agreement, bipartisan agreement already on the House Ways and Means Committee, that we should undertake fundamental tax reform, and it ought to include both individual taxes as well as corporate taxes. So that's a good starting point. Where that discussion then goes and how you make it a simpler code, how do you make it a fairer code? When I say fair, I think there's pretty widespread agreement that maybe GE should pay some taxes to the federal government each year. A lot of my local businesses and corporations pay a heck of a lot of taxes each year, and I think that company ought to have a fair share of responsibility there. But how you structure that tax code is very important for the ultimate goal of wanting to increase the interest and the incentive to invest back into the economy here in the United States, versus if you're a company, a multinational company that has a lot of operations here in the United States, but you also have operations in a couple other countries, and the money you earn over there, as soon as you bring it back here, is taxed at 35%. So guess what? They're not bringing it back here. They're leaving it in those foreign sources. They're creating more jobs in those other countries. Why can't we get them to bring it back here and invest here in this domestic economy? So that's some of the issues we're going to be dealing with this tax reform issue.
And that's repatriation?
That's repatriation.
Okay. The point you make about GE is exactly that point. GE has made, they didn't pay any taxes, or they're not paying any taxes this year. They've got $5 billion in profits offshore, and they're not going to bring it into the United States. If they've already paid taxes in Germany or wherever else they've been, mm-hmm. and they're not going to bring that $5 billion here, because the minute it hits the U.S. shores, 35% of it goes to the federal government. So they're not going to do it. So those are the kinds of things we're up against. And I believe if we cut that corporate tax rate significantly, you're going to have companies from all over the world want to come to America, because we do have the best workforce, we do have the most stable economic and political system in the world, and people want to be here. So if they can come here and make a profit and not have the government take everything away from them and overregulate them, you're going to have millions of jobs created.
You know, and on a slightly different note, related to the Ryan budget, defense. Defense spending is almost one of the largest parts of the spending. And Alex wants to know, you know, would you be against defense cuts? And if not, what percentage would you see as an ideal cut? Because if everything's going to have to take a cut, right, how much would you be willing to cut for defense?
Well, we had in the Ryan budget, we identified $178 billion in cuts. We decided, I think rightfully, to take $100 billion of that and put it into what we thought the high-priority programs were. And when I say high-priority, it's our troops, it's their quality of life, it's the weapon systems and the trainings that really make our military, it's the real muscle of our military. I believe we could go over to the Pentagon and the huge bureaucracy that exists there. You could make significant cuts in how they operate, the processes they go through when you develop weapon systems and procurement. I mean, there's billions of dollars out there to be saved. I serve on the Armed Services Committee. We look at this every day, and we're seriously going about looking at ways to save money. Again, the Ryan budget has it in there. And as I said earlier, when I say everybody has to share in the sacrifice, even the Department of Defense has to. But again, I don't think we need to cut the muscle of our military. And we can't, in the middle of two wars, and I believe Libya is going to grow into something that's going to be considered a war also. We can't do that to our troops. We can't do that to the nation. It is the number one responsibility. The number one responsibility in the Constitution for the federal government is our national security, common defense of this nation. Everything else is second to that. If we don't make this country secure here, our interests abroad secure, we're not going to have much of a country to defend and protect.
Well, another issue related to the Ryan budget was that, you know, Social Security is the largest burden to the debt. But in the Ryan plan, Social Security wasn't addressed to the extent that Medicare and Medicaid were discussed. And, you know, why didn't Republicans want to do more to change Social Security?
Well, on the entitlement side, the three programs are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Yep.
But if you look at what's really going to drive our long-term debt as a country, it's really Medicare and Medicaid that are going to do that, not Social Security. Not to say that Social Security at some point does not need to be the focus of attention of Congress to try to make sure we preserve and protect it for future generations and undertake the reforms necessary to do that. But the long-term debt that we're going to be experiencing, if nothing changes, is going to be mostly driven by Medicare and Medicaid. And I think there's a chart that we have that reflects that. And Ted, you might want to describe what that chart is saying.
Yeah, this is basically just the alternative fiscal scenario from CBO showing the growth, the respective growth in Medicare and then Medicaid and other health care spending and Social Security. Social Security, as you can see, has a small increase. It goes from about 4.8% of GDP to 6.2% at its height there. So it's a significant increase, but it's not the thing that's driving us over the cliff. And just one technical note on Social Security and the budget, you cannot actually adjust revenues or outlays from Social Security within the 10-year window. If you did that, it would not receive privileged status within the Senate. It would sort of an existential question, but it wouldn't really be a budget at that point if you did adjust that. It has special rules governing it throughout the entire budget process, and you can't do anything in the 10-year window on Social Security.
Okay. You know, and Bill B. has a question on deregulation. I guess you've mentioned deregulation, and he was wondering what you would propose to help get businesses, you know, back to work and make it a little bit easier for businesses to employ people.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's a pretty broad question.
I saved it for the end.
You know, every government agency out there probably has some sort of regulation that is going to hinder business. That certainly some government regulation is wise. Mm-hmm. But just as we're experiencing now with Marcellus Shale, we've got the federal government agencies, the EPA and the Corps of Engineers in particular, want to come into Pennsylvania and monitor oversight to have authority over various aspects of the development of Marcellus Shale. We have a DEP in this state, Department of Environmental Protection. Most of them are Pennsylvanians. They love Pennsylvania. They don't want to pollute the water, drinking water in Pennsylvania. But they are going to look at it from a Pennsylvania perspective, not from a EPA Washington-based one-size-fits-all perspective. And that's what you get out of Washington. You got the Corps of Engineers coming into Pennsylvania, now trying to rewrite the rules. When you drill a well in Pennsylvania, you have the wellhead and you have the gathering lines that go out to the transmission points to be able to send it to other parts of Pennsylvania or other parts of the country. The Corps of Engineers is now attempting to rewrite those rules, so they want to be able to monitor, regulate the lines from the wellhead to the transmission, which DEP has done for the last 30, 40, 50 years. And they've done a fine job of it. So those are the kinds of things that I believe the Corps gets into Pennsylvania doing this. Again, they're going to come with this sort of one-size-fits-all, and they're going to lay down these regs in Pennsylvania that's going to make it very difficult for Pennsylvanians to extract the gas and benefit by it. So, you know, that's one case. But across the board, you know, we've got rule upon rule. It seems in Washington we never eliminate an agency or eliminate a set of regs and replace them with something that's more modern based on the technology today. We just sort of pile it one on top of the other. It makes it confusing, makes it very difficult to do.
Jeff Davis, a member from Kentucky, has a good proposal that we may be voting on shortly that says, hey, look, if the federal branch or the executive branch at the federal level is going to take that statute that was passed by Congress and signed into law by the president and start developing regulations around it, around what's already in the statute, if that regulation is going to have more than $100 million impact on our economy, in other words, have a real cost impact to those that have to deal with that on a day-in, day-out basis, that maybe before that regulation goes into effect, it ought to be brought back to Congress for an up or down vote by the people who are elected in our districts and in our states, so that at least you have a final determination made by people who are elected, individuals who are elected by the people, rather than somebody in Washington that may or may not have you know, real world understanding of what the impact of that regulation might be. So I think we're going to see that bill on the floor sometime in the next couple of weeks, and I think it's a pretty good idea.
Good to note. And then since we are very short on time, I wanted to save this question for the end. This is from Abby, and it's regarding the Tea Party. You know, following the budget negotiations between President Obama and Harry Reid and John Boehner, there were members of the Tea Party and the Republicans who were very vocal with their disapproval of John Boehner and the concessions that he made to avoid the government shutdown. You know, during this time of hyper-partisanship, do you think that party agendas are more important than bipartisan agreement? And on that note, how has the Tea Party changed the dynamics of D.C. and what you're discussing?
I think the Tea Party has done a very effective job over the last couple of years to bringing to the attention of the American people the problems of overspending, overtaxation. They've really highlighted that. What you saw in our conference, some of the members were very upset. They criticized the speaker. I personally believe, I think I said it earlier, I think the speaker did an outstanding job of bringing a deal to the table that cut spending. We weren't talking about cutting spending in Washington 4 or 5 months ago, or even the president wasn't talking about it, as Jim pointed out. Yet we ended up with an agreement on the CR to cut almost $40 billion in savings, the largest cut in federal spending since we demilitarized this nation after World War II. We had a cut in 1995, I believe it was, when Republicans took control of the House. It was $10 billion. So $40 billion is a significant cut. It's not enough. but we're cutting, and John Boehner led us to this. There was a lot of criticism, and some of the folks that that are in our conference, they forget there's really three important numbers in Washington that to get things to move is, number one, it takes three parties, and that is the White House, the House, and the Senate coming together in agreement to pass a piece of legislation. The second is, in the House, it's 218. If you don't have 218 votes in the House, you don't pass a bill to be able to go to the Senate. And the Senate, the number 60. So in a split government that we have today, it's not even about bipartisanship. It's about if you want to pass anything, if you want to have $40 billion in spending cuts, if you want to pass a defense bill, you're going to have to come together at some point to pass these things that are critical to our nation. So the Tea Party, I think, has done a good job in a lot of cases. But again, some of our members, they pound on the podium and say, by gosh, I'm going to Washington, and if I can't get it done, then, you know, I'll go home. And a lot of them are going to go home because, or I should say a few of them, because they're...
I was going to say, a lot of them are going home.
A few of them. I wanted to edit that. Because... Again, we've got to get some agreements, and we did on this CR. I think it was a speaker did a great job.
Well, Tea Party activists have really, no doubt, added a lot of debate and energy and activism relative to our political discourse in the past couple of years, and certainly were the reason why a number of members of the House lost their elections and some new people got elected. And from at least in my area of southeastern Pennsylvania, the Tea Party organizations continue to be very active. And their voices ought to be heard, and the voices of every citizen ought to be heard, in addition to theirs. And I think the great majority of those that I've had interactions with are pretty reasonable, practical folks. Some are a little more vocal and unreasonable in what they want to see out of this process that Bill just described of how the founders set it up. But with that said, I think John Boehner, our speaker, did a terrific job in taking on the speakership just a little more than 100 days ago and being able to pass a CR with $38 billion in cuts for 6 months, passing a budget proposal authored by Paul Ryan that would cut $6 trillion in the next 10 years and start us getting some discussions about entitlement reform. So I think the speaker, the way he put it one time in our conference was he was kind of lonely. He was at the White House negotiating with the president, the vice president, and Harry Reid, and himself. So it was three against one, and that's a pretty tough situation to be in the cabinet room. But when you look at the dynamics of what he was working with relative to the Senate and the president, as well as the members of our own conference, I think Speaker Boehner did a pretty good job as our leader in that effort, and I think he's doing a great job overall.
Well, thank you, everyone. I just noticed that it's about 8, and again, thanks for having this panel. We appreciate it. If you guys have anything else you want to add, any closing remarks?
I just want to say, Jim started off thanking Dixon College. It's great to be back on campus. We appreciate you putting this together, and thanks to Ted and to Molly for making the drive up from Washington, D.C., even though Molly took my parking space out in the I told her I slashed her tires, but I know better. She writes for The Hill, and I don't want to Schuster slashes at reporter's tires.
That's okay. You just wanted me to buy Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. But again, thank you. And if I didn't get to your question, it's probably because my eyesight is not very good. And some people write very small. But anyway, I tried to get in as many questions as I could. So thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank
appreciate
you very much.